Coming up on the program today, the American housing market, the Greek debt crisis, and summertime television on our series, I've Always Wondered. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. It is the 22nd of June today. It's a Monday. Great as always to have you with us, everybody. We're going to begin with one of the old standbys of economic indicators, one of the old reliables, mostly, that is, with the caveat that it has been an up and down, mostly down, 8 or 9 years for the real estate market. There was some good news on home sales this morning, existing home sales to be specific, used home sales is another way to think about that. Purchases were up a bit more than 5% last month. That's from a month earlier. And it is according to the National Association of Realtors. It's good. It's nifty and all of that. Even more interesting, though, is who they think is doing the buying. Almost a third of buyers in May were first-timers. That's inching closer to the 40%, 40% that the National Association of Realtors thinks is quote-unquote normal. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains what it all means.
Ben Fine-Smolensky and his girlfriend were among those first-timers who leapt into the housing market in May.
We figured that it was time to maybe stop paying rent and to get a place more permanent.
Buyers like Ben are an important piece of the housing economy. They buy the small homes from people who've maybe decided they needed more space for the kids, and that family might buy a home from boomers looking to downsize. It's a circle of life thing. But Ben's decision was also an economic one.
We also thought it would be a little more cost effective instead of finding a bigger apartment to rent.
Rents in this country have never been less affordable than they are now.
That's Stan Humphries, chief economist at Zillow.
And that makes owning a home, if you can scrape together the down payment and qualify for a mortgage, it makes home ownership look very attractive.
Other driving factors may be the improving job market, or perhaps people who want to lock in low interest rates. But Richard Green, a professor at the University of Southern California, cautions not to get too excited about 1 month of data. Housing supply is tight, and he says an even more important metric to watch is new construction.
When you see a pickup in existing home sales, that indicates there's more demand for housing, and that extra demand for housing could boost the demand for new construction. Things are better than they were 3 years ago, but we're still not close to being normal.
In other words, recovering, but definitely not recovered. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Last week, we told you about a ruling out here in California where the Labor Commission said an Uber driver was an Uber employee, not simply a contractor. It's a case with potentially big implications for the very business model of the sharing economy that we talk about all the time. Well, today, a different tech firm announced that it is taking steps to deal with what is called the worker designation issue. Instacart, that's a grocery delivery service, is making some of its contractors part-time employees. Marketplace's Nova Sappho has that story.
When you place an order on Instacart, a personal shopper at a grocery store near you buys what you want and a driver delivers it to your door. Those shoppers have been independent contractors. But Instacart spokesperson Andrea Saul says the company has been testing a new approach in Boston, converting them to part-time employees. The result?
Our shoppers got more accurate at picking items. We had more on-time deliveries.
Because Saul says it's easier to train and supervise employees. The downside?
We are going to incur workers' compensation, different payroll taxes like unemployment, Social Security, and Medicare.
That's why other companies like Uber and TaskRabbit have so far avoided that approach.
What we're caught with are 20th century definitions for a 21st century workforce and economy.
Virginia Democratic Senator Mark Warner says it's time to find a new way of defining work.
The idea that everybody fits neatly into being employee, unemployed, or an independent contractor really doesn't reflect the changing nature of this economy.
One proposal is to create a so-called dependent contractor. Not an employee, but you get some legal protections. There are a host of other ideas, too. Jeffrey Hirsch, a law professor at the University of North Carolina, says the issue is heating up as the on-demand economy explodes.
The indecision and the confusion involved is what's most harmful, both for the companies and for the workers.
But for Instacart, the old designation will do just fine. The company is also converting its Chicago-based personal shoppers into part-timers and plans to do the same in other cities, too. In Chicago, I'm Nova Sappho for Marketplace.
Nice enough start to the week on Wall Street today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. There's been a breakthrough in the Greek debt crisis, sort of, kind of, maybe. This morning, Athens presented a new plan to break the stalemate. This afternoon, there was a flash on the newswire saying the current bailout will be extended. Tomorrow, yeah, well, who knows, which is kind of the way this whole thing has gone, right? But caught in the middle of all the high-level back and forth are the people in Greece who are still somehow working, supporting their unemployed parents and partners and siblings. So, from Athens, here's Marketplace's Stephen Beard with the breadwinner's tale.
For bank worker Efi Panatsokapoulou, it's been another bad day at the office. Little wonder, customers have been clamouring to empty their accounts and even their safety deposit boxes.
Today I had the key to open a deposit box for a lady, but I couldn't turn the key because the lock was stuck. And I tried to three or four times and she started screaming because she thought we didn't want her to open the safety deposit. Everybody's very stressed.
Including Efi. Her husband lost his job as an architect 3 years ago. They and their two young sons now depend totally on her pay of $300 a week.
Now I am worried about everything because everybody's in panic, so everybody takes the money out from the bank. If the bank system is destroyed, I'm not going to have a job as well.
With unemployment at 25%, millions of Greek households have been reduced to one breadwinner. Christos Mavrou, a 35-year-old sales manager, ekes out a living on $270 a week for his extended family.
My brother has no job, so I must support him, and his wife is pregnant. And of course I must support my parents.
Which means picking up a $6,000 medical bill for his mother, leaving Christos with nothing to spend on himself.
You must feel at times put upon.
No, not at all.
Honestly?
Honestly, yes, not at all. Because it's my duty and my pleasure to help my family, to support my family.
Bank worker Efi Panatsokapoulou admits that it hasn't always been a pleasure being the sole breadwinner in her household. Her unemployed husband was paralyzed by depression for more than 2 years.
He was feeling very useless because he thinks that he's the male of the family, he has to bring the food and all that.
This put the marriage under severe strain, even to the point of divorce.
I have to take care of him and I have to take care of the boys as well. And I was very, very, very tired of him being depressed, so that caused us a lot of fights.
After counselling, paid for by her bank, Efi restored her own mental equilibrium. She says the marriage is on the mend. Christos Mavrou says the crisis has strengthened his family.
Do they appreciate your sacrifice?
Silently, yes.
They don't tell you?
No, it's basically they show it to me. With their eyes, I can see gratitude in their eyes.
Amid their country's national humiliation, the breadwinners at least can feel some personal pride. In Athens, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
There's all kinds of healthcare talk out there this week. We're waiting for the Supreme Court to rule on the Affordable Care Act. This Thursday or next Monday are the next possible decision days. And there's corporate chatter, too, of mergers and acquisitions among some big insurance companies. So while we wait for all of that to sort itself out, we're going to start a series today about an idea that some doctors and other healthcare professionals have been talking about. Whether we can save money in healthcare by spending more on social services for the most expensive patients. You address those issues, the thinking goes, and you improve health and you save money. So, question number one, what are doctors doing to get the right services to the right patient at the right times? From the help desk at WHYY, here's Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein.
His entire career, Dr. Seth Berkowitz has met with patients much like one of his first, a 300-pound farmer in rural North Carolina with diabetes and heart disease.
His own diet was kind of highly processed foods, and he knew that that was making his health worse. He'd be like, oh, I know what I need to be doing, but it's just not an affordable thing for me, and I just have other priorities.
Berkowitz saw the same thing everywhere he worked, in North Carolina, the Bay Area, and Boston, and an idea hardened in his mind. Many of his sickest patients would happily focus on health if they could just deal with their more pressing problems first. So Berkowitz has designed a pilot program where he works now, Massachusetts General Hospital, that he thinks just might work for his diabetic patients.
We're working with an organization that delivers medically tailored meals to people in their houses. It's really good quality food. It's made from ingredients that are grown around the Boston area. They have their own test kitchens.
Berkowitz bets if he gets them eating healthier foods, his patients will need less medication, move around more, be more productive. He's one of a handful of researchers trying to improve health for the patients sometimes called the 550s, the 5% of patients who use 50% of the resources, a tab often paid by taxpayers. To folks like Berkowitz, it makes perfect sense, right? Spend $100 for a week's worth of meals as a way to head off the repeated trips to the hospital for $6,000 to $10,000 a pop, improve health, and save money. But doctors don't know who's going to end up in the hospital. You can't predict it well enough. So you might spend lots of money on meals for people where food isn't the problem at all. Lots of the men and women coming through the Mass General Clinic here in Revere could be a good fit for Berkowitz, like 71-year-old Tom Sullivan, who weighed 250 pounds when he first showed up 10 years ago. Today, he's 316.
Whatever I eat is either sandwiches or microwave. Garbage. Your body can tell you if you're doing good or not. And it hasn't gotten any better.
And 39-year-old Carrie Walsh, who knows what food she wants to buy but can't.
I just feel really sad because I want to take care of myself. And if I had the financial means, I'd be able to be eating better.
Dr. Berkowitz says he's got 1,500 Walshes and Sullivans he could enroll, but a budget for 50. What makes finding the right 50 even harder, says Harvard health economist Kate Baker, is having healthy food on hand might not be enough.
Maybe they don't have a place for food deliveries. Maybe they don't have adequate cooking facilities.
The stated goal of this work, improving health and saving money, hinges on lining up the right patient with the right program. Allison Hamblin with the Center for Healthcare Strategies says the danger here is they won't get it right.
We need to prove that we can economically justify this work as part of healthcare. And until we can demonstrate that this is cost-effective, it won't be a mainstream activity.
Poor targeting could sink a program financially. And right now, many providers doing this work don't target at all, instead relying on referrals or a first-come, first-serve basis. Doctors and researchers in Washington State, San Diego, and Dallas are developing predictive models that they believe will take the guesswork out and lead to the right matches. That encourages Dr. Clemens Hong, a lead researcher in this field, as long as people understand this needs to be more than a big data solution.
I think the perfect marriage is data and relationships.
Hong says a trusting relationship, one where the healthcare workers really know the patient, is essential. Remember, he says, we're talking about a group of people whose lives are turned inside and out.
So someone who's high risk today, their depression gets better and they start taking their medications and they're actually okay for a while. And then mom dies, right? And then they get depressed again and they stop taking their medications and here we are all over again.
That brings us back to Seth Berkowitz, who's also trying to marry data and relationships. In his modest, windowless office at Mass General in Boston, Berkowitz reads off a couple of questions to help him find patients best suited for the meal program.
In the last 3 months, did you ever put off buying medications so that you would have money to buy food?
All told, he's created a 100-question survey. Crude as that may be, learning a patient's complicated backstory may be the most effective way to move forward. Even if cumbersome questionnaires are the best they've got, people in the trenches like nurse practitioner Christine Gossel say they'll take it.
You can see how frustrating it is for the patient. Their weight steadily rises and the insulin steadily rises, and it's this vicious cycle that's never stopped because that one issue that could fix it all isn't being addressed.
Gasilla says if it comes down to the meals or more insulin to really help Walsh or Sullivan, her money's on the meal every time. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Dan's story was produced for us with support from the California Endowment Health Journalism Fellowships there at USC Annenberg. Coming up...
I think I got $150 for the Cheers theme. And I had a very powerful lawyer.
How musicians can make some real money for television theme songs that they write. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's up 103 points today, 0.5%, closed at 18,119. The NASDAQ up 36 points, about 0.7%, finished at 5153. The S&P 500 climbed 12 points higher, 0.6%, to 2122. We told you earlier about existing home sales. Well, here you go. All that news lifted home builders. Pulte Group stacked up 0.3%. Lennar picked up 0.75%. Apple, as you might have heard, changed its tune on its streaming service, shaking off its plans not to pay royalties to musicians during the three-month free trial period. Apple cooked up 0.8% today. Fitbit continues apace after last week's IPO. The wearable device maker trekked up 14% today. And you, no matter what you wear, are listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy. From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department issues durable goods orders for May. That's stuff like computers, cars, and coffee makers. Where are you going to put it all? The Commerce Department also reports on new home sales for May. And it's a sound you probably only hear now in older movies, the ding sound of a carriage return. A patent was issued for the typewriter on June 23rd, 1868. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Fast casual is that restaurant style that falls somewhere between McDonald's and not McDonald's. Chipotle and Panera are two frequently cited examples. Boston Market is right in there, too. Used to be one of the biggest names in fast casual, known for its chicken. And then all of a sudden it wasn't. CEO George Michel is trying to bring the company back. Mr. Michel, it's good to have you here.
Great to be with you, Kai.
Let's get this out of the way right up front. Do you really call yourself the big chicken at Boston Market?
Absolutely. That's what my business card says, and that's how I introduce myself to all our employees. It's always frightening to speak to a CEO, but the minute I say I'm the big chicken, I get a big laugh, and then we get into the conversation.
You know, I was looking at a map of Boston Market restaurants, which are concentrated mostly in the northeast part of this country, I think it's safe to say. And the thing that occurred to me was Dunkin' Donuts. I mean, if you go to Boston, literally Boston, not Boston Market, but if you go to Boston, the city, you can't turn around without hitting a Dunkin' Donuts. And I wonder how much you're thinking about expansion into the rest of the country, as Dunkin' is trying to do.
Well, we are right now concentrating on the key markets where we do very well. So this year we're opening a majority of our restaurants in New York, in New Jersey as well we're focusing on, and at the same time in Florida. So that's our main focus. In the meantime, we're also penetrating the shopping center segment. We realize that there is a big gap in food courts for food like the great food we serve at Boston Market.
Who's your competition?
Our competition varies from daytime to nighttime. Huh. We are a bit of a hybrid. We're really not just a restaurant. So in the daytime, we operate and we compete with restaurants. However, between 4:30 and 6:30, we really compete with supermarkets.
As in people coming into your place and buying a chicken and taking it home?
Buying a family meal, absolutely. You know, we are a great convenience for people that are busy. Moms and dads that are thinking around 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, what they're going to put on the table. So either they're going to stop at a Boston Market and get a family meal for 3 or 4, or go to a supermarket, do their shopping, and buy a rotisserie chicken on their way out.
How do you compete against some of the bigger fast casual chains? I mean, you guys have 450 stores, which objectively is a lot, but in the space, maybe not so many.
Yeah, you know, we're going to continue to grow. I mean, we used to be a much bigger chain at one point, and we had to close some of the restaurants. But what's amazing is everywhere I go, people know what Boston Market stands for. People have a great love for the brand. You know, this year we're going to open 12 new restaurants. Next year we're planning to open 20 to 24. And we've been fine and competing in the marketplace.
You have this thing you do on Thanksgivings. You go to the store in New York City, right? The flagship store in New York and work Thanksgiving, 12-hour shift?
All our executives, they go out and work on that day. We work alongside our staff, and we have a lot of fun.
You get all your fellow C-level executives out there working with you?
Yeah, we are all scattered across the country because we want to learn, you know, what goes on in San Francisco versus what goes on in Dallas, what goes on in New York, what goes on in Detroit. And we've had record Thanksgiving every year because of what we've been taught by our people as well.
What's your go-to meal when you go to a Boston Market?
I love eating a quarter white with no skin, boiled potatoes, and steamed vegetables.
Mr. Michel, thanks very much. That's George Michel, the CEO of Boston Market.
Thank you.
Used to be summertime television was all about the reruns. Not so much today, as you know. There are nearly 40 new shows hitting the airwaves, or whatever your favorite digital content distribution method might be. And that, in its own roundabout way, brings us to today's installment of that series we do, where you ask the questions and we answer them. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer, by brain work and blatant.
Kathy Lane from Sarasota, Florida, sent us a question. How much, she wants to know, do musicians earn if their music is chosen for a TV show theme song? Marketplace's Caitlin Esch is on it.
Here's a song you may recognize. Gary Portnoy was just 25 years old when he co-wrote the Cheers theme song in 1982.
I think I got $150 for the Cheers theme. And I had a very powerful lawyer, and he just said, look, you know, whatever is going to be is going to be, but you're not going to make your money up front, so go for it. Sometimes you want to go where
everybody knows your name. This song was Portnoy's first big break. It also happened to be the most successful thing he's ever done.
I mean, my license plate is the number one, H-I-T, the number one, D-R.
That's One Hit Wonder. But turns out that's not such a bad thing. Portnoy gets paid in royalties every time the Cheers song plays. In recent years, the song has been licensed for commercials, selling cars, soda, and even insurance. He won't say how much he's made off this one song, but he will say it's enough to live off of. Portnoy is now 59. He says he enjoys a simple life outside of New York City.
I collect Japanese maple trees. I'm very interested in studio pottery, handmade studio pottery, American and British, and I watch Judge Judy every day. So I would say I'm semi-retired.
But for the right offer, Portnoy says he'd be willing to take up songwriting again. Entertainment lawyer Josh Greer says writing one theme song for one hit show that plays over and over again can basically fund your retirement.
Yeah, you don't make hundreds of thousands of dollars. You end up making millions of dollars.
How those royalties are calculated is a complicated business. There are whole organizations that specialize in tracking, collecting, and distributing royalties for songwriters. Again, Josh Greer.
I think the simplest thing to say is the more often it's played, the better. And if it goes into syndication, then it just becomes a constant flow of royalties.
So that's what happens when you're hired to write a song. But what happens when you get that call? A television network wants to use your band's little-known song for their TV theme?
I think we initially deleted the email thinking it was some kind of joke, you know?
That's Brett Sparks from the band The Handsome Family. Brett, along with his wife and bandmate Rennie Sparks, released the song Far From Any Road back in 2003. From the dusty mesa, a looming shadow. Fans of the HBO show True Detective will recognize this song as the theme of the first season. Far From Any Road was never considered one of the band's more popular tunes, but since becoming the True Detective theme, Rennie estimates it has earned more than all their other songs combined. Husband Brett Sparks says for working musicians, licensing is a great way to make money.
I mean, it's pretty much the only real chunk of income out there.
Don't forget t-shirt sales.
Don't forget t-shirt sales, exactly.
So Far From Any Road was not exactly a hit song. If it were, it's fair to say HBO would have had to pay a lot more. Entertainment lawyer Josh Greer says to license a popular contemporary song, a TV network would probably have to pay six figures.
Yeah, the tricky part is everybody really wants to know what the actual price tags are, and those are, for the most part, confidential.
But perhaps the biggest benefit of all this exposure for the Hansom family, tons of new fans.
You know, years ago, people wouldn't look to a TV show or a movie or a commercial to find new music. But nowadays, they do.
Well, that was considered selling out, and it was considered lame. There's no punk rock anymore.
And the best part? These fans buy music. Digital sales for the Hansom family have increased ninefold compared to what they were before True Detective. I'm Caitlin Esch for Marketplace.
From the dusty mesa, a looming shadow grows.
This final note on the way out today, as I remind myself I have to watch True Detective. We haven't weighed in this space about the currency wars being waged in the Treasury Department. Plans by Secretary Liu to take Alexander Hamilton off the $10 bill and replace him with a woman. Ben Bernanke weighed in today. The former Fed chairman says he is, quote, appalled by Liu's proposal to drop a man that Bernanke calls the best economic policymaker in U.S. history. Far better, Bernanke goes on, to drop Andrew Jackson like a hot potato off the 20 and replace him with a woman. Me? On this anyway, I'm with Ben. All right, that's all she wrote. The Dow up 103 points today, 0.5%. The NASDAQ gained 36.7%. The S&P 500, 12 points. 0.6% higher. Bridget Bodner, Austin Cross, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios are the production staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. And oh yeah, this is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.